This is GeekSpeak, episode 40 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Keelum. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon.
How's it going?
It's good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
All right. We got some feedback from last week. I don't know if you recall, we talked a little bit about VI and Emacs.
Yes. So text editors that are running on 40 years old, somewhere thereabouts.
So we had an informal poll. Right. We asked people to email in if they use VI or Emacs. And 50-50, half Emacs users, half Vim users. But I thought what was interesting is that
and one user who is 50-50 within their own workflow.
That's right. Yes, at least one person that actually could do either. Didn't really matter. And I got good feedback from listener Marcus on the cursor movement, which I thought was interesting. He says, by the way, HJKL, this is the keyboard navigation that we were joking about in VI, is loosely based on the ASCII meanings of four control characters. Control H is backspace, control J is line feed. And the old ADMA 3A terminal used Control H, Control J, Control K, and Control L for the cursor movement, and he thinks that the first to use that this near standard. Okay, so that was the first to use it, and that was before the VT100, which is the terminal protocol, if you will. And in anything, and that was kind of cool to hear that the cursor movement goes back so far. Additionally, the ADM 3A was implemented using a single board of 7400 series ICs. So reduced count, control character count, was important.
Which also means that escape mode is actually, originally with VI, a pass-through to the system for control characters.
Right. Yeah. Which is just beautiful.
Which is, yeah.
Control system, right down to like the firmware of the board. Anyway, so we also got from Janine. She's a listener, works in the East Bay. And Vim has been my editor of choice for pretty much my entire career as a software engineer. It's efficient and works for everything I need. So why switch? I got to say, I pretty much agree with her. Also, the Dvorak question came about. And we talked about the percentages of how fast Dvorak was compared to QWERTY. And it looks like it's really more like 5 to 10% increase.
That's what we had said before, right?
Well, we had some flavors of like why. But the thing that was interesting that Steve mentioned is that Dvorak shines, quote, where Dvorak shines is reduced wrist strain. I switched 17 years ago or thereabouts. My wrists were getting torn up by 80 hours a week of programming and writing. Ergo keyboards helped some. Dvorak helped more. Now I mostly use Dvorak on a Kinesis Ergo keyboard, and wrist and hand soreness is a thing of the past. The Kinesis Classic keyboard, by the way, is a thing of beauty. It takes some getting used to, but after that it becomes a cold dead hands peripheral. Do you understand the reference to that?
Yes.
But I love that he's using gun. What is that?
A gun metaphor.
Well, it's not really a gun metaphor. It's like
a gun analogy?
Yeah, thank you. Gun analogy. In any case, that's a really good point, that if you are getting repetitive stress syndrome in your wrists, which happens to a lot of people, changing the layout of your keyboard would definitely modify that.
And you don't mind never being able to use anyone else's keyboard ever again.
Let's see,
by
Miles,
touch typing.
If you're a typist and you're typing 40 hours a week, the most important thing is the amount of time, like how your keyboard feels. So ergo keyboard's good. If you still have problems, switching keyboard layout would definitely change.
Yeah, I got to be honest. If you're spending 80 hours a week coding, you
I
need
said 40, but yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, I thought you said 80.
He said 80. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's excessive.
Yeah, that's excessive. But, you know, you love to program. And besides, it's 40 hours programming and 40 hours writing. I mean, but other things, you know, writing emails, love letters. You spend 40 hours a week on Facebook.
No, not anymore.
How so?
Oh, I decided to take a break. One too many police snuff films for my taste.
What do you mean? I think we talked about this before, actually. But basically,
yes.
In your feed, because you're a politically motivated person online, you get videos of people getting murdered.
Yes.
In your feed. And they autoplay.
Yes.
It's pretty
well,
disgusting.
I did discover how to turn off autoplay in both the app and on the desktop.
Oh, that's important.
And I actually posted it to Facebook saying, like, here's how to turn off autoplay. And it's at least for the iPhone, it was ridiculous how complex it is, like how many levels deep you have to go to turn off autoplay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible. It's doable. But
so if you had autoplay off and you weren't auto-seeing the snuff films, why did you disabled from your phone?
It was an issue where there was a video, a gentleman in Charlotte got killed, and there's some supposition with video evidence that the police may have dropped a weapon after he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was already in question as to whether or not he was armed in the first place. And then there's the whole issue of North Carolina as an open carry state. And it ends up being extremely wearisome to have others say, like, for example, it starts off, well, he had a gun, the police were
justified.
Yeah, or feared for their life, and so they had to shoot. But North Carolina is an open carry state. Well, if he was threatening an officer, then you have to – well, he didn't have a gun. But if – even if they were – he was making a threatening movement and the police don't know that.
So what you're saying is you saw this video and you saw the you led to the conclusion that most likely you'd have this kind of discussion with people that you
– I was already having that discussion with them. And it came to a head when I started – when I saw the – exposition of the video saying, like, this person didn't have or did not appear to be carrying a gun, and a gun appeared to be dropped in the middle of that clip, the wife's recording from her mm-hmm. from her camera, and or widow, I should say. And I had seen so many times, like, for example, the young man in Baltimore who had his back broken in custody. And when there was a investigation of it, they said, yes, there was malfeasance. Obviously, there was someone did something wrong. But we're not going to make any charges, bring any charges to any officers who had access to him, because we can't be sure which one it was. And so we don't think we can get a conviction. Mm-hmm. And it was just a situation where I just did not want to watch that unfold again. I would rather
for your
go
own
and
personal
mental health, my mental own personal health. Mental health. Yeah. I wanted to go see other things and do other things and hang out with my family and just take a break from it for a while.
Okay. Do you find like you have a more obligation to speak out? I mean, you're very public. We say that you're politically, what do we say? Politically pedant or
a political junkie.
Political junkie. You're highly involved and engaged in this debate of malfeasance of police officers. And I would assume that in doing that, because you're level-headed and, you know, very clearly, you know, you're very good at communicating, you have been for years, that your voice is useful in moving people towards your perspective. Don't you feel that at some level that's part of being an American?
Well, as for moving people in my direction, yes, I think there have been a handful that I have swayed, but for the most part, people's preconceived notions are really hard to change. It's something we already know.
Mm-hmm.
It is nice to be able to exchange information with friends of mine who are quite different from me politically, that especially when they're from high school, where I have a history with them. And so we can remain civil and like each other as people, even though we disagree strongly. It's mm-hmm. a great place to be where you're not just stuck in your bubble. You're able to get more information.
Do you think that you're changing some of their perspective or opening their eyes at all to what your perspective is?
Opening your eyes is a little too strong. That presumes that I know the truth. And mm-hmm. in many cases, I do get information from them as well to get myself out of my own bubble. None of us is perfect in that regard. And so it is nice to have that back and forth. That's what I'm going for, the ability for – you know, liberal, conservative, authoritarian, you know, anarchist, you know, those different areas to be able to coexist and speak and talk about public policy without it turning into a rage fest.
Okay. But at the same time, this time around, you decided, I can't take it. I can't do it this time.
Yeah. In general, it's not the friends of mine. It's the friends of friends mm-hmm. that will jump onto the thread and then
– where you become more anonymous to each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also the people that I am friends with, because there are some folks that were so far what I considered off the rails that we just couldn't – interact anymore. But there are, you know, many of those friends that I still have there, I still like them. We have our disagreements, but that's fine. they may be friends with, like, for example, for them, they are far off from me politically. Mm-hmm. For them, they have friends where they are the center of the universe and I am on one side and they have another person that's on their
– Right. So that other person's highly diametrically opposed to your general perspective.
Yeah. And in many cases, I would say objectively racist or sexist or, you know, or the like. And so it's there. It's also seeing the public debate that goes along with it. And it really is seeing everything having to do with the case. I've been kind of unplugging from the whole media in general.
Like, can you be objectively racist?
Can you be objectively racist?
Yeah.
Sure, you can be objectively non-racist.
Because isn't racist a feeling? I mean, you can do something that's objectively racist, but you can't be objectively racist because it's perspective of the human thought, right? You can represent yourself multiple times as objectively
racist.
Well,
now you're getting into the whole metaphysics of what is objective reason.
Long debate.
I think it kind of tinged me
because I said a moment ago I was complimenting you as a friend of mine who I respect their opinion, speaking eloquently. And I thought, wow, if it was a black guy I didn't know and I said speaking eloquently, I'm basically being racist when saying that, right? Because, well, he's a human being. Of course he's speaking well. Have you heard that terminology?
Sure.
When I said that to you, when I said, you know, you speak eloquently, whatever it was that I said, I thought
– I took it as a compliment.
Well, good. Well, you know me, and so you know what I think of you. But I definitely had the back of my mind where like, oh, is that a racist comment? That is a continual thing that goes on for
– I never heard of, in terms of eloquence.
Well-spoken.
Yeah, so well-spoken.
I think I said well-spoken first and then eloquent.
Okay.
But anyway, doesn't matter. Should we move on?
Sure. I guess the moral of the story is to unplug from social media when your mental health starts to degrade. We think about taking vacations from our jobs, but sometimes we need to take vacations from our social interactions as well, whatever they may be. They may not be political as they are in my case. They may be just the fact that you need a break from hanging around other people and needing and having that requirement to respond to other people, to like, to – that's something what a lot of people have talked about. They feel that obligation to validate the other person, to like it, to respond to it, to the like. And I think it is important to unplug and give yourself a break when you notice the cracks starting to show.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a wise thing to do for your own sense of well-being. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot to say that you have some kind of obligation to do anything at all. But I do appreciate that you engage in that debate. And when I do participate and see how eloquent you are in your argument, I regularly will read it to my wife. Like, listen to what Miles said. So I'm glad you're still.
Oh, I had no idea. That's kind of awesome.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. Hey, we talked a couple weeks ago about a image coming off of Facebook and how Facebook was removing images of nudity. And you can go back to a couple episodes ago about that. And it was interesting. We had a correction on that. But I won't get more into that except to say that Facebook clearly can censor the content that's on their service. And it would be even hard to say that it is censorship in the traditional political term because it's a private corporation.
Well, it is censorship.
Yes.
But it is not government censorship, which is what the First Amendment deals with.
Right.
Private corporations are not subject to provisions of the Constitution.
That's right. And it is clearly how Facebook would decide to put things on and off of their service, as does YouTube, as does any website can do things of their own accord. The censorship that might be of concern is more of when, you know, the Great Wall of China actually edits files and restricts content to their users.
The Great Firewall of China.
The Great Firewall of China. But Krebs on Security has an interesting article about the democratization of censorship. And can you tell me a little bit about this article? First, Krebs is this great writer about security.
Brian Krebs, yes.
Yeah, really, really good stuff. We've quoted him before.
Been following him for going on 10 years now. He is on the forefront. We've talked about him before on the show where he gets into enough people's faces with regard to people who are organized crime online and doing all sorts of bad deeds that he has regularly been a target where people have
attacked him,
tried to SWAT him. You know, in other words, call the police saying there's an armed person on the premises trying to get the SWAT team to come and get involved. In other words, threaten his life.
Right. And of course, the translation of threatening your life is if you call, say, and you know, there's a shooting in this house, and there's people running in there, and there's gunfire all around. When the police come, they're fully armed, and they break through the house, and it can be an extremely dangerous situation. Yeah,
right. And the thing is, he has taken all of this in stride and just been, this is the vocation that I have taken up. Mm-hmm. And it is, people have recognized it as a public good. Mm-hmm. And
like a journalist.
Fact, yes. Yeah. And in fact, Akamai, which is the caching server, geolocation caching, or geocaching rather.
Basically, this means it's a company that provides CDNs, or content delivery network. Mm-hmm. And they basically have servers with hard drives at multiple hops across the internet and duplicate your content. So if we put a picture up for GeekSpeak and we are using one of these CDNs, and Akamai is kind of the famous one, mm-hmm. There would be a copy of that image in New York and in China, like all over the place. And so any user went to get it from somewhere local.
Right. And the reason why you would do that, because you're thinking, wait, the internet is worldwide. Why can't I just get it from a server in Japan? That's what happens. There is always the issue of the speed of light and the speed of electrical switches.
Yep.
And so even if you're going the speed of light, going across the country, like from the west coast to the east coast of the U.S. or going from Europe to Japan, that is still going to take the amount of time necessary for light. The transit time to get to the server and the transit time to give the response back, under optimum conditions, that would be the speed of light. But it's going to be much less than that because of the hardware involved.
And actually, the amount of hops you actually go through is important. The amount of switches actually accessed with the HTTP protocol.
And when you're trying to get a website to come up quickly, you want to get it, you know, optimally, you want to get like 100 millisecond response time, or, you know, definitely within 1 second or two.
Uh-huh.
And because most of the time people will just go like, I don't feel like waiting. I'm going to go to the next link. And when you add in that transit time just to communicate, you start to lose before you even start.
Right.
And so that's why you have these geolocations so that if you are in New York, you end up hitting a server that's in New York, and so you don't have that transit time involved, and you just have the speed of their servers.
At Netflix, we have a server hub on the West Coast, down the East Coast, and somewhere in Europe as well, which is actually our servers that do the processing of data and everything, you know, that deliver the applications, all that. And then we also have a whole bunch of these physical boxes that hold our entire catalog of movies all over the place. I don't even know how many there are. Mm-hmm.
Also like at ISPs, different ISPs, yes. So that they can reduce their bandwidth costs going out of their network.
So when you're loading an app, you're actually hitting one of our servers, and it's actually Amazon's cloud services on the West Coast, East Coast, or Europe. And then if you actually are starting to stream a video, that video file is coming probably a lot closer to you.
Mm-hmm. So the reason we bring this up is because Akamai was allowing his website to be transmitted elsewhere and also acting as
– Akamai was allowing Krebs's website to be hosted on multiple locations.
Yes.
Yeah.
To be available anywhere, high availability of many different locations. And they were also acting as a sort of security blanket in that everywhere on the internet, especially if someone doesn't like you, they can launch what's called a distributed denial of service attack.
DDoS, sure.
And that is – they'll, for example, hit your website with – just like you would go to someone's website, they would have what was known as a bot, a compromised computer, hit that website
and over
and then have a whole bunch of other ones do the same thing. So you can't really distinguish when you're looking at the logs whether or not it is a real person or whether it is part of the automated attack.
Right.
That's why they're very difficult to combat in many cases. In addition to that, they can have so many machines hitting at the same time that you end up with just overloading the resources. Akamai is great because –
even the network. Without Akamai, you could even destroy the ISP's network infrastructure, basically stopping all traffic from flowing because the switch was overwhelmed. So with Akamai, I'm assuming that would be a lot harder to do.
Yes. Akamai, one of their reasons to be is that they can get out this information and cache that that information that you have and handle for banks and other large organizations that may have many enemies or maybe state-sponsored attacks, things like that. Well, as we said earlier, Brian Krebs is notable within the community as someone that has been a thorn in organized crime online. Organized crime doesn't tend to take well to people who are a thorn in the side of organized crime. So they have launched repeatedly distributed denial of service attacks against Akamai trying to take his site down.
Mm-hmm.
And Akamai, to their credit, has said, no, this is important. And having him having this voice taken away as a form of mob influence is not what how we want the internet to be.
And this is really good that Akamai is willing to do this, because if Brian Krebs had to handle the cost of all that traffic, it would bankrupt him.
Sure.
Right? I mean, because he's not making that much money off
right.
of services.
To handle as much traffic as we're going through at what he normally has to deal with would cost somewhere in the range of $150,000 a year, which is far more than a journalist is going to be able to manage for just giving out a website or blog.
Okay. So what's the news? So that's the background. Go ahead.
Yes. Until Akamai was hit with over 600 gigabits per second.
Oh my.
Sustained attack.
That's incredible. So 650 gigabits a second requests. Just that much requests.
Yes.
And a HTTP request is not a very large payload. It's not like you're
Well, it may not have just been HTTP, but yeah, there are a variety of things you can do to try to take a site down.
Right.
But it was twice as large as the previous largest attempt they had ever seen.
So what did Akamai do?
So Akamai at that point was saying, like, yeah, we can't – this is really punching into our bottom line. Like they're looking into – the possibility of millions of dollars of liabilities to keep this up. And they have fought the good fight, but they just went like – they had to cry uncle. And Brian Krebs, to his credit, was saying like, I don't blame them. Like this is insane.
So does that mean Krebs is down?
It does not, because Google has stepped up to the plate.
Oh, really? And they have, of course, a very large infrastructure.
Yeah, they have something called Project Shield. It's a program run by Google to
do exactly this.
Yes, to help protect people like journalists from online censorship. And this is an article that Brian Krebs talks about, which is the democratization of censorship. It used to be that it was just state-sponsored actors, you know, someone in Iran who's the head of a government who's high up in government saying, we don't want these dissidents to be able to get this information, so we're going to block it. Or we talked about the Great Firewall of China.
Sure.
Say, we don't want you to have access to this information.
Where it's really a barrier of a network layer. Like one part of a network is isolated such that traffic can't get into it. That's one way of doing it. And that's, you know, in North Korea, that's like that, right? Like traffic is completely restricted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go on.
But the issue now is that it's not just a state-sponsored actor that can cause these problems. Anyone who has a botnet, in other words, someone has used an exploit to get on someone's machine and then be able to use that as a jump-off point to attack a third party.
In a war ground situation, it would be a terrorist type of attack, right, where it's an individual small group that's not doesn't own a lot of territory. You don't want to use the terminology. I know it's a lot of heavyweight. We'll get into that some other time.
Yeah.
So anyway, this can be an individual or a small group that does this attempt attack. It's no longer a governmental takedown.
Right. And in addition to that, we've talked about the Internet of Things from time to time. You have all these little devices that have access to the web, including refrigerators or, you know, your
car. We're talking about a lot more. The ability to make a large botnet is increasing all the time because people are making more and more exploits in their homes.
It used to be just you had a Windows XP machine. Okay, stop doing that. Go to Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 10.
But now you bought a security camera and you don't even know it's
exactly. The security cameras are another huge one because they're always on.
Well, so it sounds like the Shield project of Google is going to be is going to be something that's going to kind of be required in some sense to protect us, right?
Yes.
Is Akamai helping with it, or is it just like handing it over?
I think Akamai is just handing it over.
Because it seems like the thing to do with this would be to make a protocol where Akamai and Google and like a few of the large companies could come together and have one protocol that helped each other. Because then you're distributing it across all resources rather than one owner. You know, because at some point the request could get large enough where Google's like, this is too expensive. Of course, that could be a while.
If you have enough resources that you're really putting a dent in Google's ability to publish on the net and be quick about it.
We have other problems.
We have other problems. That's getting into the area actually where you start getting public-private partnerships where Google goes like, look, this is what's going on. They start contacting the FBI.
They start
getting involving the State Department. Yeah. Something that individual journalists don't have the resources to do.
Well, thanks, Miles. So you recall the Defense Distributed. Do you know what Defense Distributed is? It's an organization that's been putting up plans to 3D print handguns.
Yes.
Yes. And there's a court case, Defense Distributed versus Department of the State. And the general idea is, this is free speech. We can put these plans up. Defense Department says, no, you can't. That doesn't sound like a good idea. And this has been fighting in the court. And most recently, in a 2-1 decision, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals was not persuaded that Defense Distribution's right of free speech under the First Amendment outweighs national security concerns. So national security won on this one. The majority – should I read it? You want to read it for
me? Fifth Circuit also, just for a point of reference, is the South, Louisiana, Mississippi area.
In general, though, this idea of trying to take down knowledge to make us safer seems like a fool's errand. That's my take on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the idea that you want to make a – you don't want somebody to necessarily profit off of it, meaning like they don't want this company to be able to sell ads and make an income and profit off of distributing stuff that is questionable on its benefit to society. But and their argument of the First Amendment right seems to me pretty important. So when you start attacking and winning against First Amendment, it's tricky.
This also, is an area where the Second Amendment actually has, I think, a greater precedence to say that the right of the populace to arm themselves to I don't want to quote the Second Amendment.
Yeah, no, we know. Yeah. It, yeah.
That you would not be allowed that you would be allowed to go to a gun store and buy that, but you wouldn't be allowed to make one in your own home, mm-hmm. which is what this amounts to. If you had a milling machine, would you be allowed to bore a hole and make a working gun? And
well, of course, there's no rules against that. I mean, you can do what you want in your own shop. You can't sell them without a gun license
right.
to sell weapons.
And so there comes the question of what about the plans – to like the plans for giving to a milling machine.
Giving the plans to how to make a gun with a milling machine kind of rule set, in no way is that restricted. No, obviously not. That's completely clearly First Amendment. And I'll give you a reason for that. That's in books. That's in paper books. You can get a library.
Right.
So from that perspective, you know that we're protecting that knowledge, if you will.
But what's not in general public ability is knowledge of how to create a nuclear weapon.
Yes, we did decide that that was important enough. And that's the thing. This is a outweighs national security concerns is the argument here. I totally agree that nuclear weapons are important enough to subdue the amount of knowledge we have about it.
See, now you're saying there is
guns,
a line.
There's
so now
totally.
To decide-
but I don't think national security and handguns, you can argue that any knowledge of being able to hand create handguns can any way affect national security considering the amount of guns we already have in the states. Like it doesn't seem like who cares? Now you can have more of them. In some ways, I don't see the
argument.
I
don't agree necessarily with the rationale, but I believe that the rationale they were using was we have restrictions for felons or others, whether they be foreign nationals that are on a terrorist watch list or whatnot, to purchase firearms through established channels.
Yes.
And that ceases to be an impediment if you can print your gun.
Okay. But Miles, this is my point here. I can go to the hardware store and make a gun with plumbing parts. Like this is not – this is – now and I granted that I'm a maker and an engineer and all that stuff.
Well,
I've got a lot of training.
Let's also be clear that the plans here for making a gun are – the gun is basically a zip gun. It's not –
yeah, it's a one-shot.
You're not making an M16.
Gun of plastic. That's right. And that zip gun compared to one that I'd make at the hardware store, which is also going to be a zip gun, right? Rubber band controlled, whatever. They're equivalent in almost every way except that one requires an expensive machine and almost no knowledge, and the other requires almost no expense and some knowledge. But that knowledge, I don't put that at high level of importance because that's something I taught myself. I don't know how to do it. I've never done it, but I know I could do it. Like mm-hmm. there's not a lot of skill here to do this.
My take on it is the horses are already out of the barn.
Yeah.
3D printing already exists. Being able to send plans around already exists.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ban it in one area, that means that in another jurisdiction it is open and you download the plans. And it's going to be whack-a-mole where you are always three steps behind.
Okay, but that's the point of this that I am concerned about. And that's why it's not a Second Amendment issue in my mind. It's a First Amendment issue. Because if you successfully say some knowledge is not acceptable, mm-hmm. and it's tenuous that it has any relevance to what safety and national security is. I mean, the nuclear weapon aside, because that's clearly – in my mind, I think most rational people would say that is a national security concern. If you start moving in another direction, well, then is it maybe it makes sense financially not to be able to print from your home inkjet cartridges that ignore the DRM on a printer.
Right. What I was saying, though, is that it is a fool's errand. I don't think that they can do that. Mm-hmm. I do think that if you really wanted to restrict these types of activities,
yes,
that you restrict access to ammunition.
You mean gunpowder?
Yes, but also just ready-made bullets. But yeah, because just the deterrent of having to make your own bullets is enough to deter a lot of folks, especially because they become a lot more valuable and you don't want to just
– You don't want to use them. You want to aim better?
But I don't know that that's also going to be realistic in this country either, because you know there were a lot of people when Obama was first elected that said, "Oh my God, he's going to take all of our guns," and there was a huge run in the gun store and ammunition was just flying off the shelves, and then there was no gun control. And
the thing that frustrates me about this kind of stuff, and it has to do, it reminds me of security theater, in the sense that, yes, you could say ammunition. Let's just stop ammunition. Except that you can make an air-controlled weapon that kills, like just compressed
yes.
air. So like there's ways to get around all these things. So you're not going to stop.
Bear in mind, when you're talking about an air –
But volume. I mean, it's really the amount.
If you're talking about an air rifle, you're not talking about the same velocities in most guns. You're not talking about the same mass that's being shot through the air in many cases.
So actually, I thought that was true, but air guns have become very popular. In the UK, they're extremely popular for hunting mm-hmm. because you can't get gunpowder guns as easily. And so explosive guns, I don't know what they're mm-hmm. called. Anyway.
Standard gun.
Yeah. Exothermic reaction guns. So a lot of investment's gone into these. And now you can get 38, that's the grams of a bullet. I don't know weapons very well. But
38 is the size.
Yeah, the
diameter,
size. Yeah,
diameter.
22 and 38. But you can get a pellet that size that it goes almost sound, speed of sound, in air. So that is a deadly – like that is extremely deadly. Now, they're not machine
yes.
guns. They're not
yes,
auto fire.
Yes, absolutely
stuff,
extremely deadly. Gunpowder
is more
pellets
so.
Do go faster than sound
in
many cases. So that's what I mean though. It's not – there is still a minimization of that effect.
I think that what you're talking about is making a barrier of complexity is a good way – is a part of a deterrent. Making scarcity is a deterrent. So if you structure the society to be in that way, and this lacking the stopping the spread of being able to print guns does add some kind of barrier. And if we produce enough of those, it helps at some level. Is that kind of the idea you've got?
Yeah. At the same time, like, I am an advocate for some gun control. Not all. I'm not like a ban all guns. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I don't think it would be possible in this country.
Right. So you're more of a practical person.
I try to be pragmatic about it, mm-hmm. but I mean, who knows? But this just seems an area where it's like even if you are on the side of gun control, there are too many unintended consequences of this.
Yeah.
In addition to it not being effective.
And besides, humans having guns is not the problem. Artificial intelligence taking over is the problem. So what's Google got up its sleeve lately?
Google a while ago was making – or has been pushing the envelope in terms of image recognition.
Yeah.
You have a random photo, or I want to say random to the computer, but you know, your own personal photos.
I take a picture somewhere, I upload that picture, and Google right. says what it's in it.
Right. And they have something that they call show and tell, TensorFlow. And they have actually trained it so that it can say, you know, in this particular example, it has a couple of dogs on a beach, and it correctly captioned it as a dog is sitting on the beach next to a dog. I mean, the wording was a little stilted. It could have said next to another dog. But considering the fact that it got – there are two dogs and they're both sitting on a beach, that was extremely impressive.
Wow.
The news behind this, though, is that Google is open sourcing the model for its machine learning system called Show and Tell, which is the backbone to their TensorFlow.
Mm-hmm.
Tool.
And the model, this model release is faster to train and better at captioning images, meaning it's better at – does it actually producing helping you with the natural language aspect of it or just in general listing out the things?
I think they try the – I mean they're trying to make it fit with natural language. Their goal is to try to make it so that you have not just a prepackaged set of captions but something that sounds like a valid well-coiffed bit of text to describe it.
It's interesting. This open source package is actually better than the 2015 image caption contest run by Microsoft, the COCO contest. The winner of that, this one's better than that, and it's open source. So, I mean, okay, additionally, I've been using this service of Google for a while in Google Photos, updating all my photos to Google, and I can now search, you know, Paris trees 2014, and I see a park in Paris that I was at in 2013. I took a picture of. There was a tree in the background. It's incredible. And you can do all the Google search features of like, I want to see trees plus dogs minus water, right? Like it's that good. And it's a little eerie. And anytime it succeeds, I have this kind of giddy scare.
Like I feel less like a unique snowflake.
Not important at all. It's no, I actually don't have any fear of it or concern of it, but I'm definitely excited by its use. At the same time, I'm understanding that I'm adding to Google's power. Mm-hmm. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing.
The ability for self-actuation is something that is still out of range for computers that I have seen thus far. But in terms of specific tasks given to computers, we're running into fewer and fewer that humans can do that computers can't.
Right.
And I honestly think it's only a matter of time before computers can actually start programming open-ended problem sets.
No, I totally disagree with you. We're so far out from that. This is very clearly a pattern matching. Now, good. Granted, we're pretty good at it, but clearly, what it's doing is just here's 4,000 images of dogs and beaches and sand, and here's an image. Are any of those things in there? Like that's all it's doing. And I know that's amazing, but it's not like.
I wonder whether or not you were overestimating how much variety there is in the typical programming environment.
But keep in mind that we're not talking about them programming and understanding what the meaning of a dog is.
No, they don't have to understand.
I know, but that's the point, is that it can do things because it has large sample sets. So I love the idea of training with positive feedback systems. Like that whole concept is wonderful. But the truth is there's only certain things you can do if you have to rely on here's a whole bunch of definitions, now do something like what I just defined. There's only a subset of knowledge and of thought that can be done in that way.
Right. But what happens when you get to the point when you say, I want a shop that sells this types of things and I want to be able to have a sale and I want to be able to – some things that – are part of a basic package, and then you have to hire a programmer to fine-tune it or make some other arrangements to it.
I agree that
there are a lot of areas where you have a well-defined set problem set that there's a lot of existing there's a large existing corpus of information of algorithms and of general architectural layout that already exist that could be plugged in together, and then you need the logic to be able to make sure that they integrate well together.
I totally agree, but then you need the logic as the piece that's still going to take a human mind, meaning that it's amazing the amount of APIs we have available to us, and this is another one, right? This is an imaging, analyzing, and categorizing system, which is extremely powerful and amazing. At the same time, we have whole giant infrastructures of APIs with regards to the stock market. We have giant infrastructures of APIs with regards to Twitter feeds and news feeds. there is a lot going on that are available with really simple implementations for engineers to do. Right now, it's easier to make an application than it ever has been before. But that doesn't mean that we're just going to be able to randomly create have computer systems randomly create useful things.
I didn't say randomly create useful things. I meant the day-to-day things that we many times need a programmer for.
Yeah, okay.
We will not need.
Well, yeah, totally. But that's
what I was saying.
But that's
not saying that they would self-actuate. I'm not talking about them creating
Miles,
a new.
Every API is like that. Every time you make a complex thing with a simple interface, you do that. You reduce the need for programmers. When Flickr came out with their API to allow you to look at people's feeds and show images and display them and find images of certain types, that capability was really easy to do. All of a sudden, there was programming 101 steps that were like, hello world, here's Simmons images. And that is something that would have been a lot more complex without that API.
That is something where I think we're differing. Like, I think of chess. Teaching a computer how to play chess is, I think, a very different problem from how do you defeat a grandmaster at chess.
Sure.
Different in order of magnitude with regard to the complexity,
mm-hmm.
or many orders, I would say. And when you're talking about an API, that is still a human being involved to encapsulate and put multiple things together. If you're talking about a computer making an API, then yeah, that is something that I am talking about, which is taking disparate pieces that were not together before and putting them together.
But how does a system that categorizes images to you correlate to that?
I think of it in terms of there was a time when we said there's no way that a computer chess program could beat a grandmaster. There was a time when we said that
But every time that was said, it was just a matter of time. But
right.
Go on.
And I am saying that it's just a matter of time before a computer can take over most of the roles of a programmer.
Most of the roles?
Yeah. I don't think necessarily that a computer will be able to do everything that is required for example, the Google image recognition. Unless AI and machine learning really makes another breakthrough. But even so, with regard to the captioning system that they're talking about here and many other algorithms that are out there, they are based upon machine learning. They are a product of code that no human being actually knows how it works.
Yeah, I totally get that. But the fundamental thing that they're doing is not a new thing. They require a large data set of defined things. And from that, I mean, that's where we've gone for the artificial intelligence. You know, we failed miserably at like actual generic artificial intelligence. And all we have done in the last 12 years or 15 years mm-hmm. or 50 years, I don't know how long the range is. I should bring on a professor that knows all about this, has said, oh, well, what we can do is look at large data sets and from the existing data sets, process that in such a way to come up with interesting information. That's how Amazon's, you want to ship this, you like this thing, you probably want to buy this thing. That's how that works. How Google ranking works. That's how Netflix's categorization system gives you your videos to watch. All those things are based off a very simple premise of here's a giant data set. Look at the patterns. Now find something that predicts what this other thing will do.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all interesting and fascinating, amazing and powerful, but they are not creation. They're not the same thing as doing something new. That's what I'm saying.
Once again, we're getting back into the topic of I don't believe the computers will self-actualize.
Right, but you're saying that they will create – they will replace the ability to be creative?
When they are told the goal, they will be able to figure out the steps to reach that goal without human intervention.
Given there's a lot of data already exactly about that goal?
Not exactly about that goal. That there are enough building blocks, enough pieces.
I agree. And
they're given a big bucket of Legos.
Yeah.
And then you say, I want the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
And they will figure out how to position and which pieces to use in order to make that Eiffel Tower
yeah,
without you being involved.
But that pattern of having a robot build the Eiffel Tower from pictures, or just saying, you know, here's a picture, make a representation in Legos, right? And all it does is build a Lego representation, not of that picture, but of a picture that you would describe the same way. You're right. That's not like, that's pretty close. It's a few tied together. It's a few things of pulling things together and making it work. But those things that would have to be done are going to have to be done by a human, because someone's going to have to take those two APIs and match them together. Someone's going to say, oh, I got an automatic remote, a remote control, or a robot that builds Legos, great, and gives 3D maps. And I got a 3D map service from objects. You know, all these things exist. But the tie-up of those things is not an automatic process, because you would have to have – I mean, you're talking about like a verbal communication to do it?
Not necessarily. But the reason why I bring this up is because I think that with regard to – a computer making these things. A computer is a logic engine.
Mm-hmm.
And it is different from a human being. Human beings are pattern recognizers. We have to train ourselves to act like logic engines.
Hence all the bugs we produce.
It does not seem likely to me that a logic engine will be cut off from doing these logical processes, and only the pattern recognizers that have to translate themselves into logic would be able to do. That's the crux of my argument.
I totally get that. At the same time, it is something that – how will you give it direction to do that? Let's do the make a 3D picture of this photo. Okay, so we got the engine that can take the photo and break it down and go, look, it's the Eiffel Tower and three dogs on a beach.
That's not the
picture.
Type of thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about, let's say, Uber. And you describe, I want to have a taxi service, and I want to have these users, and I want them to be able to communicate at this level. I want them to – like setting up business processes, and then having a computer know, okay, here's the web server software I'm going to be doing, and here's the modules that I would need to code to get that to work, and here is the communication lines for there, and here's the data storage that would be necessary, and here's the fields. And I don't want to do the fields in this way. I do want to denormalize in this case because that will make it faster.
What you're going to have to do there is build a whole system that understands general business application development.
And I'm saying that those exist. In terms of computer science, we have textbooks on algorithms that you can load in. We have business models, and a lot of what we do is commodity.
Miles, the AI is not going to know what a person is. The AI is not going to know that a person –
It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. You're not talking about
talking about an artificial intelligence level that's more complicated than you think you're talking about. That's the problem, is that
– I am not talking about artificial intelligence. I'm talking about something that's machine learning or –
Okay. Machine learning is artificial intelligence.
You're right.
You're not talking about general
purpose
artificial
intelligence. I'm not talking about sentience.
We're both getting away from sentient. That's fine. But what I'm saying is that for you to be able to say, I want to have an Uber, some system has to understand that you need maps. Some system's going to have to understand that you're going to have two types of agents, if you will. And those agents are people, and those agents' people have physical location. And those physical locations are bound by the rules of geography. And geography is managed slightly by weather. And all these things you have to understand. These are general concept ideas of the universe that computers do not know. And so
– On the contrary, I think they can.
Well, no, they can know, but we've been trying to do this for a long time. So – taking the leap of here's a whole bunch of data and here's something else, how does it fit into that data, is one thing we're very, very good at. Having a here's the universe, let's do something in it, is not the same thing.
I think we are still talking about two different things. You are talking about the how do I make a business. I'm talking about you have a description of the business. How do I implement
it? And how do you describe that business? As long as you say I describe that in Python, I'm all good here. Like – how are you going to describe that business? How are you going to describe the Uber?
As a set of requirements, doc.
What's the language definition for the requirements doc?
For that matter, I would think it would be English.
English. Okay. So now
for me, it would be, but I mean –
Right. So English. That's great. English is a good one. Are you going to have something that understands English?
Enough to make a logical model? Because technical documentation –
Miles, you're a programmer, dude.
Requirements documents – are not Proust. They are not Tennyson.
No.
They have a very regular model to them.
Yeah, you'd have to say that they have a logic to them. And so as long as they have a very clean logic that can feed into a logic engine, and a human being who's a pattern recognizer can communicate that language to that logic engine, you're good. The problem is you're talking about programming. Whether it's in English or not, that's programming.
The requirements documentation is not the same as the implementation.
I agree.
And so what I'm talking about is from requirements, which can be very detailed and very logic-oriented, is not the same as programming. And I think a computer will get to the point where it can take a requirements document and turn that into an implementation.
And I think one way of saying what that is the requirements document is the source code and is a very complicated compiler. You're still programming.
Sure, you're still programming.
Granted that if you put it in English, someone that has no computer language skills could still program it in English. I think at some point we'll get relatively close to that. And there might be some fine tweaks. You said in the beginning you might have somebody have to touch some things after
that. Wait, so what are you arguing with me about?
My point is that that's still programming. There's nothing different about that. All that's different is the compiler, which we get better at all
the time.
The
API is a much higher level, or the language is a higher level.
That's it. It's not doing anything but doing exactly what the human's telling it to do. It just happens to be that you have a much more rich language set that's better for humans. And we've gotten better and better over the years at doing that. I don't think there's a big step here that you're talking about. We will get better and better and having languages get better and better. But at no point will it be like, I just wanted this thing and this computer program programmed it for me. It will be, I need this very, 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 very specific thing. And that's called source code. But we should move on.
Okay.
Plain text passwords.
Ah, yes. So there are teens on the internet.
I've heard of them. I have a teen on the internet.
Causes many parents no trivial amount of discomfort with their teen being on the internet. The idea of, let alone the practice of.
Yes.
Well, there is a website called iDressUp. It is pitched as like love, fashion, find inspiration, discover creativity. It's basically like fashion plates, but online.
Okay.
Fashion plates for us older folks.
Okay. What's a fashion plate?
Fashion plates were on TV. I never actually owned them, but I remember them being – they were a cutout of a figure, and then you had dresses that had paper tabs on them that you cover the tabs
called
around
paper dolls.
Yeah.
Fashion plates?
Yeah.
I always called them paper dolls. Okay, go on. And they're awesome, by the way.
And well, this site that allows you to, you know, play with paper dolls, as you put it, without ever actually touching paper,
which is weird
for us, for kids who've never played with paper dolls, it's completely normal. This site had an atrocious security policy. All of their passwords were kept in plain text.
Where?
On their website.
Okay.
So 5.5 million user credentials were leaked.
Of course, this is email addresses and passwords. And of course, very commonly people use the same password for lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've used this service, if you've played with paper dolls on the internet, change your passwords.
Right. And don't use the same password for multiple sites.
All right.
But the thing here is that if you build a system based upon faulty security,
mm-hmm.
It's very hard to fix it. It's very hard to just treat it like here's a bug that needs to get fixed. You have you've built on sand.
Right.
Because there are so many things that are going to need to authenticate and so many different ways that have come in to authenticate. So what you're supposed to do is someone sends in – assuming that you're using passwords. Some people say you shouldn't be using passwords anyway. You should find other ways of doing it. But if you're using passwords, you should send your password in. You pass it through a one-way hash,
mm-hmm.
Preferably with a random salt, something that makes it so that two people that put in the same password, it doesn't come out to the same hash
that
comes out. So you can't just look to see which hash is
and
the
when
same.
Miles says hash, he means mathematical scramble.
Yes. And then you put that into the database and make it so you can't access it so that you just have some interface like a stored procedure that says, here's my username, here's the password coming from the user. Now do your magic and tell me, do they authenticate or not?
Which means that the the website
or a
front end, if
yeah.
you will,
yeah.
has no capability of actually reading that value. It can't say, give me that value. It can only say, if I give these two values, did that match?
Yes.
And that's all
it
can do.
And if a hacker broke into the system and got access to the database and dumped all the data out of the database, that they would still have to spend a huge amount of effort just to get any of the passwords out.
Right.
Here, when you have a plain text password, it's really hard to just go in and go, oh, well, let's just convert all of this into the way they were supposed to do it. You know, which hash algorithm do we need to do? Do we need to put that into our database setup? Wait, does the server speak that way? What about all the utilities that are coming in to check the password? Do we have more than one point coming in? Especially when you have things like plain text, you don't generally enforce that there's going to be a common path for them to go in and authenticate.
Right.
You have all these ad hoc methods to do it because why not? It's just there. So, word of warning.
All right.
Avoid iDressUp. If you use iDressUp, change your password. And folks, if you're making sites out there and you don't quite understand what I'm talking about with regard to a hash and a salt, get help from someone else. You yes. need it.
Get an artificial intelligence to help you. I
wanna... An artificial intelligence engine would not make this mistake.
I won't take the debate. Let's move on. California enacts a law requiring Internet Movie Database to remove ages on actors on request.
Now, bear in mind, this was not specific to IMDb.
No, it's actually any entertainment website that people pay and have their resumes up on. The idea is that there's actually a lot of discrimination via age. Mm-hmm. And so if you're on the service and people are filtering out, first off, you can't really lie on one of these services, because if you lie on one of these services and then someone hires you, you're now in a situation where you've lied on your job application, right? So it's really bad to lie on these. At the same time, it really makes no difference what your age is, except that there is discrimination in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, unless you're running for highest office of this country, lying will always be an impediment to your success.
So it does make a lot of sense to do this. And so Jerry Brown stood with thousands of film and
the governor of California.
Thank you. Conservative Californians to urge them to sign AB 1687, the law that prevents age discrimination in film and television casting. And the SAG and AFTA are both – these are unions.
Screen Actors Guilds.
Yeah. Have all supported it. And it's kind of cool. The thing is, it is about when you're a paid customer, you can do this. So my first thought with this was, oh, wow.
Wikipedia.
Yeah. It's not for the famous people, right? Because if you're really, really a famous person, you've already had, you know, as an actor, you've already had 15 different jobs. People know your career. It's all public. And in some sense, your age is known. And if you're a working actor for a long period of time, knowing your actual age is not that important in the sense that people are hiring you because of what you've done. You have a resume. This is for people starting out, right? This is for somebody who's 32, who's an amazing actor, and they decide they want to do the new Friends episode, and they much rather have 20-year-olds, right? Mm-hmm. And even though that actor can totally pull off the 20-year-old and can totally do the part. So I totally support this. I think it's cool. Even though it's weird, it's definitely – it's right in there with hiding data, right? It's just like the
gun
law for me.
Well, here's the thing though. It's a California law. What happens when you host your site outside of California? What happens if you have repeaters outside of California?
Yep.
What happens if you have a geocaching server so that you're accessing it from New York and the server that you're hitting is in New York?
At the same time, we're talking about the film and television industry and two of the major unions supporting it. So you could imagine just not having your site, your resume anywhere else except for IMDb. And IMDb is going to abide by that because there's so much scrutiny around it. I think you're probably okay. We'll see. Hey, tell us about Windows 10, would you? We never talk about Windows anymore. We really should.
Windows 10, that we talk about security issues with Windows on a regular basis. Well, this is the opposite. Windows 10 is doing something that I think is very impressive. I want to give kudos where kudos are due, which is the Edge web browser, which is a successor to Internet Explorer, will soon be running in a virtual machine.
That's pretty cool.
So whenever you run it, it's as though it's a computer in an operating system inside of an operating system just to run the browser. It's going to use a little bit more RAM than what you would otherwise. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're doing something on the order of paravirtualization, which is a way to minimize those that resource utilization because the virtual is the same operating system type as the host.
Is the JavaScript engine going to run on this? The entire browser going to run in a virtual machine?
The entire browser.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So I'm wondering with Chrome, Chrome, and more recently with Firefox, you've seen the technology where they have each tab is so each website is in a different process.
Yeah,
it's like a separate program being run. This is the first I've seen where the browser itself is running in isolation from the rest of the operating system.
So here's my hackle on this one: when you build an extremely tight security system in place or an operating system in place, and you say, okay, this process has these rights and doesn't have any other rights besides that, and therefore it's safe. And then you find a vulnerability in it, and there's a bug, and there was leakage, and there was a memory stack problem.
Nothing is ever safe, but
right.
Safer. Defense
so
in depth.
All that we're doing is adding another layer of that virtualization. It's not fundamentally a different piece of hardware. There's not a different bus. There's not different RAM. It's just that there's another layer that's a virtualized system that is defined to be a virtualized system. Is the benefit of this that we trust that virtualized system better than the browser's protection?
In theory, the virtual machine cannot see its host. It can send out information along predefined ports, as it were.
Yeah.
And the host knows about the guest, obviously. That's what you talk about when you're running a virtual machine, that the guest is the machine within the machine. And
that.
It can look for different ports to say like, oh, here's a request for printing and here's the printing data. Here's a request for
but do you understand my file. Do you understand my conceptual concept that these are actually just two applications running on the hardware? One's we call it a virtual machine and the other we call a browser. But they are both just pieces of software that are running. There's nothing magical about this.
Well, if you're going to take that tact,
why is it
then
safer?
An operating system is just another program as well.
Yes, but a virtual machine running on an operating system is very much like a computer program running on the operating system. That's what it is. How is it different? Tell me
why.
Okay,
so you have the hardware and then you have your operating system on top, which smooths out all the differences so it doesn't matter whether you have an NVIDIA card or an ATI card. They're pretty smoothed out. You just talk to the operating system how it wants to talk to video memory. Then you have a virtual machine, and that is a program that's running on like any other program on top of that other operating system. But then you have a second operating system inside that virtual machine that all it knows about is the hardware as it's presented by that virtual machine. And then you have the browser run inside of that guest operating system. So it's not just two programs running side by side. There actually is some depth there.
Okay. When the child virtual system, operating system, the secondary operating system, the child operating system says, I want RAM allocation – or the application inside that says, hey, operating system, I want RAM allocation. And the virtual machine says, I want RAM allocation. It's asking the hardware, the virtual hardware, to give allocation.
Yes.
So then the host application says, hey, operating system, real operating system, I want memory allocation. Once that is done, the sub-application – does it have access to that memory allocation?
No, there is memory isolation there.
So it is kind of the entire time wrapping everything it can in a virtual way.
Yes.
So the worst case scenario would be the host application would have a vulnerability. The operating system would have to be able to know about that vulnerability.
The worst case scenario is the virtual machine has a vulnerability so that you're able to poke a hole in that cocoon to get out so the guest could get out into the host.
Right.
That's much the same as issues we've had with JavaScript security, which is you have the runtime engine of JavaScript, that environment, that sandbox. And in general, it's very hard to get out of that sandbox, to get to the browser process underneath and then to the operating system underneath that. But that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So what my point is that we've been doing JavaScript development with virtual runtimes for JavaScript for a long, long time, and we've gotten better we've gotten better and better at having that sandbox capability. And now Windows 10, which is a new operating system, some degree, is coming around and has a virtual machine software. And as long as that virtual machine software has no bugs, you're totally gold. But if it has bugs, you have the same problem.
That's like saying I don't know that that's necessarily true. I mean, that's – yes, every program has bugs. But if you have these multiple layers, to compromise your machine, you have to get through every single layer.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas before you had to break through the JavaScript sandbox to get to the web browser process to then get to the operating system to then wreak havoc, now you have to break out of the JavaScript sandbox, break into the browser process to break into the operating system process, detect that you're in a virtual machine, then break out of the virtual machine to then break into the operating system of the host to then wreak havoc. That means that each layer has to have a bug.
Yeah. Cool. So you applaud this?
Yes. Okay. Each layer has to have a bug in order to get through to actually exploit the system. So every layer you add is another chance for you to stop. Another, you know, you have the castle model of you pull the drawbridge and they're stuck between two walls, you know.
All right. We are going to wrap up today's show, but you'll have a couple extras at the end to go through quickly. Yes?
Sure.
This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can reuse our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geek said, hello. Thank you very much to our patrons and to our intern Chandler and to our support geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, Democratic Censorship Unplugged Zip Gun. And thanks also to Michael Newman of PetStar Music, who provided our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 40 of season 16. Hey, Miles, thanks for your 16 years. You started September 2000, so this is officially 16 years of GeekSpeak.
Woo!
Don't you feel amazing?
Yes. Now my experience with GeekSpeak can get a driver's license. There are people who are climate science deniers that no matter what happens, like, it's not our fault. And you know what? The Earth probably isn't warming anyway. So what is a climate scientist to do about this? Well, what they'll do is they will look at all of the papers and comments and utterances of climate science deniers and then analyze them.
So the real scientists are analyzing the climate science deniers?
Yes.
To look at what?
Climate science deniers. to look and see, do they have any commonalities? What is the theme? And what they found was interesting, that oftentimes they conflicted with one another and they would even conflict within the same article or paper.
Nice.
They would say, actually, the world is cooling. But then later say, it is warming, but it's not because of humanity.
Awesome.
And
so
then
they're
say,
not inconsistent. They're
but then say, it's warming and it's due to what we've done, but there's nothing we can do to stop it. And they will have all of these positions in the same paper, lots which of. Are mutually exclusive of one another.
All right. Here's one. Have you ever played Street Fighter? I actually had a Street Fighter game in my house for a while. Did you come play that?
Yes, on my Raspberry Pi with an emulator.
Oh, now you're playing with an emulator. So,
yeah?
Yeah, I used to have the actual physical box in my house. Remember that?
I never had it, actually.
No, you came to my house and played it.
I did?
Yes. I had it in my
house.
Oh,
right. Yeah. Oh, the stand-up box.
The sit-down box.
Yeah.
Yeah, we played
a
lot.
The coffee table style.
And I think you always kicked my butt.
Of course I did.
So Capcom is the company that makes Street Fighter, and Street Fighter V for PCs includes a knockout move. Unfortunately, it's not actual a user's move. It's a rootkit.
Yes. To get a game to run as fast as you may want it to as – if you were a game developer, you might want to, you know, get better access to the hardware and make sure that you have your timing right and try to bypass any security protocols that the operating system may have, so that – because security checks take longer. You know, it takes a while to unlock the deadbolt in your door. It'd be a lot faster if you could just open the door and walk in.
Absolutely.
Well, rootkits, by virtue of disabling the security of a system, or at least bypassing it for certain programs, also leaves you open to, if there are any bugs in that particular program, your system is now wide open. Rootkits also have these side effects.
Wait, so Capcom actually in their official game added a rootkit to make the game faster?
In order to have their application – have the programs, the constituent libraries and the like, run as an administrative user.
Right.
So that they didn't have to worry about permissions, could do more things without having to be.
This is just like the Dropbox thing that Dropbox did.
Yes.
Where they're kind of cracking the system
like
so they could get better access, easier to use.
And one of the drawbacks to rootkits, though, is that you are patching a kernel to an operating system. And many times, if you are doing that without the knowledge and consent of the operating system manufacturer and the tests that go along with it, other things tend to break.
Get this. The Capcom.sys completely blows away the safety feature, if you will, and you can actually just send command codes to the memory address that the game is running and do anything you want on the system once the game is installed.
Yeah. We were talking about memory protection earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoops.
So if this were running on a virtual machine, it would allow you to break through that cocoon. For example.
Oh, man. That's not good. All right. Thanks for that one. Let's do one more.
Oh, we've got to do the iPhone 7. People have bemoaned the fact that...
so bad.
Yeah. People have bemoaned the fact that the iPhone 7 does not have a headphone jack anymore, an eighth-inch jack.
Yes.
And so people have been upset about this, and there's been a lot of hangering. But they still purchased the iPhone 7.
They knew this when they purchased it, right?
You'd think.
But also, you get a little dongle with it. You just plug it in. Yeah. It's no big deal.
An intrepid user decided to go on to YouTube and show how you could get that jack back with a simple hand drill to drill into the spot where the
iPhone 6 had one. Yeah.
Yeah, where the headphone jack used to be.
Did he like specify the size of the drill bit and stuff and teach people how to do this?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, to be clear, all he's doing is drilling a hole. He's not adding a jack to the phone.
Right. This is satire because where that jack used to be is now a tactile engine. Like, there are other things there besides a headphone jack.
This phone does not have a headphone jack.
It doesn't have facilities for
a headphone
jack.
Did you watch this video? Was he actually going, okay, and all you have to do is get the iPhone, have a jack back?
Yes, it was a step-by-step.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And
I don't know how many people have
for
done
us watching it, we're laughing because, like, it's obviously satire to us. But there are many people who did not get the joke.
Yep.
And actually drilled into their $1,000 device.
That's not good. Okay, quick North Korea update, please, Miles.
North Korea had a mistake on their DNS server.
How so?
Normally, you can't query a public DNS server to find out all of the hosts that are attached that are governed by it. This is something that was around in the early days of the internet, but people have learned since then that it's usually a bad idea to just be able to query a DNS to find out everything that's on a system, because that's just asking for a malicious programmer to go in, go through all of the computers on that list and look for vulnerabilities. North Korea, their IT personnel did not get the memo. And so they had all – this is not a typo – 28 websites for that country.
Wait, North Korea has 28 websites?
Total, yes.
Okay.
That are accessible through DNS. Otherwise, it would be through an IP address, of course. But 28 websites, and so someone on Reddit went like, hey, I wanted their DNS, and it shows there's 28 websites in their whole, you know, national top-level domain. And so everyone on Reddit went, oh, well, I use hyperbole there, but many people on Reddit went, hey, that sounds interesting. I wonder what they have up there. So Reddit, a very non-small website,
mm-hmm.
and all of their users, then went to go take a look and completely overloaded all 28 websites with traffic.
Oh, yes. Wait, what was it? What was it we used to call it slash dotted?
Yep.
When it was slash dot that had all that traffic.
Yes.
But now it's Reddited. Mm-hmm. When your site goes down because people are interested in it on Reddit. All North Korea taken down. Okay, I'll mention one more just because you put in the feed and it's about virtual machines. So this is a malware that evades detection with a novel technique. So the way that you normally test to see if software researchers, security researchers, check to see if something has malware in it is they run it. But they don't want to run it on their normal machine, so they run it in a virtual machine. And in virtual machine, they can then take a look at what it's trying to do.
A completely separate air-gapped computer, actually, not sometimes. A virtual machine. But yeah.
But sometimes it's a virtual machine, too. But in any case, yeah, completely protected machine, so you can run this dangerous, potentially dangerous piece of software, and then you inspect exactly what it's doing. You take a look at all its network traffic, you take a look at all its disk writing, and you basically really know, because you can at any time turn the machine off and do it. Complete parts of the operating system, mm-hmm. of the hard drive, and know what it's done. So that's how you kind of forensically detect malware. Mm-hmm. So this malware that was not being detected for a while was doing a very simple thing. And it was saying, hey, are there recent files in this computer? Oh, there's not recent Word files in this computer? I'm not going to do anything malicious. Because basically, researchers always take a clean instance of a Windows operating system, mm-hmm. put it on as their base, and then run the software.
Yeah. And then take a single, for example, test Word document. They put it there
and see
what happens.
So this basically means that malware writers are getting better at detecting whether they're being detected and writing obfuscation for that purpose.
Right. So we get on there and we'll say, how many Word documents do I see? Oh, I only see one or two. That's probably some researcher trying to con me, so I'm not going to do anything. And therefore,
it doesn't look like vulnerability.
No signature came up. Yeah.
Awesome.
But then when it comes across a real person's computer, which has 50.
It goes and
more,
downloads its payload and does the real nasty stuff. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for doing this with me today.
Always a pleasure.